bowed his head, eyes closed, fingers pressed to the bridge of his nose, and trembled. Rose could have cried. She sat on the grass under a tree, reading over and over William Carlos Williams's poem, The Red Wheelbarrow. What did it mean? Rose wasn't sure she knew. How could she confess this to Gardner? She burst into tears. Before Christmas, Gardner told Rose the time had come for them to be together. It was the weekend. He'd carefully prepared everything. Rose had a big fight with her favourite driver, Murray. Murray was young and dedicated and fun, really, but just as obnoxious as all the other paid guardians. "You stay two blocks behind us," said Rose. "Don't let him see that you're following. I'll be spending the evening with him, you understand, and you can wait outside quietly, unobtrusively. Now, Murray, don't ruin this for me." Murray had his doubts. He was a small, muscular man of Russian-Jewish descent who'd been a San Francisco policeman for 10 years before getting this job, which paid him 3 times what he'd made before. He was also a very honest, straightforward and decent guy, like all the drivers, and he let it be known he didn't approve of this professor. But he followed Rose's orders. Gardner picked up Rose about 6 o'clock that evening and drove her to the mysterious old Georgian mansion in old Palo Alto, following a curved drive through the manicured garden up to a porte-cochere that couldn't be seen from the street. Rose was wearing a simple lilac cashmere dress for this blessed evening, with black stockings and black leather shoes, her hair free down her back with a small diamond clasp over one ear. The soft, leafy grounds of Gardner's house were beautiful to her in the gathering darkness. It had been a splendid place once, that was obvious, with old creaking hardwood floors, richly panelled walls, and a broad central stairway. But now it was littered with Gardner's books and papers, the huge dining-room table, a glorified desk, with his 2 computers and various notebooks strewn about. Up the stairs they crept, over old worn red carpet, and down the long dark hall to the master bedroom. A fire blazed in a stone fireplace, and candles burned everywhere. Candles on the mantel, candles on the old high-mirrored dressing-table, candles on the night-tables. The bed itself was a delicate antique 4-poster, with an old rice design, Gardner explained, which his mother had inherited from her mother. "Just a full bed, a small bed," he said. "They didn't make queen and king beds in those days, but this is all we need." Rose nodded. On a long coffee table before an old red velvet couch sat trays of French cheese, crackers, black caviar, and other choice tidbits. There was wine there, uncorked, waiting for them. This was Rose's dream, that this, her first experience, would be one of the highest love, and that everything would be perfect. "I take Holy Communion," whispered Gardner as he kissed her. "My innocent one, my sweet and gentle one, my flower." They had taken it slowly, kissing, tumbling under the white sheets, and then it had been rough, almost divinely rough, and then it was over. How could anything have been so perfect? Surely Aunt Marge would understand, that is, if Rose ever told her. But perhaps it was best to tell no one ever. Rose had kept secrets all her life, kept them close, sensing that to divulge a secret could be a terrible thing, and perhaps she would keep this night secret all her life. They lay together on the pillow, Gardner talking about all that Rose had to learn, all that he wanted to share with her, how much hope he had for her. Rose was just a child, a blank slate, he said, and he wanted to give Rose all he could. It made Rose think of Uncle Lestan. She couldn't help it. But what would Uncle Lestan have thought had he known where she was now? "Can I tell you things?" Rose said. "Can I tell you things about my life? About the mysteries of my life that I've never told anyone?" "Of course you can," Gardner whispered. "Forgive me that I haven't asked you more. Sometimes I think you're so beautiful that I can't really talk to you." This actually wasn't true. He talked all the time to her, but she sensed what he meant. He hadn't said much about wanting to hear her talk. She felt close to him as she'd never felt close to anyone. Lying beside him felt so perfect. She could not tell whether she was sad or supremely happy. And so she told him what she'd never told her friends ever. She told him about Uncle Lestan. She started talking in a low voice, describing the earthquake and that sudden ride up into the stars and into the heavens, and she went on to describe him and the mystery that he was and how her life had been guided by him. She said a little about the horrid Christian home, skipping quickly to the night she was rescued. Again the dramatic ascent, the wind, the clouds, and those stars again above her in the naked sky. She spoke of Louis and Uncle Lestan and her life since, and how she sometimes thought about her mother of long ago, and that island, and what an accident it was that Uncle Lestan had saved her, loved her, protected her. Quite suddenly Gardner sat up. Reaching for a white terrycloth robe, he stood, wrapped it around him, and walked away towards the fireplace. He stood there with his head bowed for a long moment. He put his hands on the mantel and let out a loud groan. Cautiously, Rose sat back against the pillows, pulling the sheet up to cover her breasts. She could hear him continuing to groan. Suddenly he cried out, and as she watched, he rocked back and forth on his bare feet with his head thrown back. Then came his low, angry voice.
"This is so disappointing! Oh, so disappointing! I had such hopes for you, such dreams!"
he said. She saw him trembling.
"And you give me this stupid, ridiculous, cheap high school vampire babble!"
He turned around and faced her, his eyes wet and glittering.
"Do you know how you've disappointed me? Do you know how you've let me down?"
His voice grew louder and louder.
"I had dreams for you, Rose, dreams of what you might be. Rose, you have such potential!"
He was roaring at her. His face had grown red.
"And you feed me this foolish, pedestrian schoolgirl trash!"
He turned to the left, then to the right, and then went towards the bookcase on the wall, his hands moving like big white spiders over the books.
"And for God's sakes, get the damned names right!" he said.
He drew a large hardcover book down from a shelf.
"It's Lestat, damn it!" he said, coming towards the bed. "And not Lestan! And Louis is Louis de Pointe du Lac! If you're going to tell me ridiculous, childish stories, get it straight, damn it!"
He hurled the book at her. Before she could duck, the spine caught her in the forehead. A fierce, stabbing pain spread through her skin and gripped her head. She was stunned. She was maddened by the pain. The book fell down on the comforter. The Vampire Lestat was the title. It was old, and the paper jacket was torn. Gardner had gone back to the mantelpiece, and once again he moaned. Then he began again.
"This is so disappointing! So disappointing! And on this night of all nights, Rose, this night, you can't begin to know how you failed me. You can't begin to know how disappointed I am. I deserve better than this, Rose. I deserve so much more."
She sat there, shaking. She was in a rage. The pain went on and on in her head, and she felt a silent fury that he had hurled this book at her, hurled it right at her face, and hurt her in this way. She slipped out of the bed, her legs wobbling, and in spite of her trembling hands, she pulled on her clothes as quickly as she could. On and on he spoke, down into the crackling fire, crying now.
"And this was to be a beautiful night, such a special night. You cannot imagine how you have disappointed me. Vampires carrying you up into the stars. Good Lord in heaven! Rose, you don't know how you've hurt me, how you've betrayed me."
She grabbed her shoulder bag and tiptoed out of the room, rushing down the stairs and out of the house. She had her iPhone out before she hit the long, dark driveway calling for Murray. The headlights soon appeared in the deserted street as the big limousine coasted up to her. She'd never been so glad to see Murray in all her life.
"What's the matter, Rose?"
Murray demanded.
"Just drive,"
she said. In the big black leather back seat of the car, she put her head down on her knees and cried. Her head was still aching from the blow, and when she rubbed her forehead, she felt the soreness there. She felt stupid, suddenly, for ever trusting this man, for ever thinking that she could confide in him, for ever allowing herself to be intimate with him. She felt like a fool. She felt ashamed, and she never, never wanted anyone ever to know about it. For the moment she couldn't understand the things he'd said, but one thing was clear. She'd trusted him with the most precious secrets of her life, and he'd accused her of borrowing stories from a novel. He'd hurled that heavy book at her, not giving a damn whether he hurt her with it. When she thought of herself, naked, beside him in that bed, she shuddered. The following Monday, Rose dropped Professor Gardner Palestine's classes, giving family problems as a reason for having to cut her schedule. She never intended to see him again. Meanwhile, he was calling her constantly. He came by her house twice, but Aunt Marge agreeably explained that Rose wasn't home. "If he comes again," Rose told Murray, "ask him please to stop bothering me." It was a week later, on a Friday night, in a bookstore downtown, that Rose saw a paperback book with the title, The Vampire Lestat. As she stood in the aisle examining the book, she saw that it was number 2 in some sort of series of novels. Quickly she found several others. These books were called The Vampire Chronicles. Halfway home she was so upset, thinking about Gardner again, that she was tempted to throw the books away, but she had to admit she was curious. What were these books about? Why did he think she was repeating stories from them? Since that awful night, Rose had been in a kind of daze. She'd lost all appetite for school, for friends, for everything. She'd been moving around the campus as if in a half-sleep, scared to death of running into Gardner anywhere or everywhere, and her mind kept circling back over what had happened. Maybe it would do her good to read these books and see just how unfair to her Gardner had been. Rose read the entire weekend. On Monday, she cut class and continued reading, complaining to Marge of an upset stomach. Sometime around Wednesday, she heard voices outside the little house and looked down to see Murray arguing with Gardner Palestine at the curb. Murray was clearly angry, but then so was Gardner. Finally, the professor turned and walked off, shaking his head, his hand flung out before him, clawing at the air, and he appeared to be murmuring to himself. By Friday of that week, Rose felt remarkably calm about the situation. Whatever she was thinking no longer had much to do with Gardner. She was thinking of the books she'd been reading, and she was thinking of Uncle Lestan. She knew now why Gardner had made his distasteful and hostile accusations. Yes, she could see it quite clearly. Gardner was a self-centered and inconsiderate man, but she knew now why he had said what he had said. Uncle Lestan's physical description perfectly matched that of the vampire Lestat. And his friend and lover, Louis de Pointe du Lac, was certainly a dead ringer for the Louis who'd rescued Rose from Amazing Grace Home for Girls. Dead ringer. Now that was a good pun. But what did it mean that this was the case? Not for one moment did Rose believe in vampires. Not for one second. She no more believed in vampires than she believed in werewolves, or Bigfoot, or the Yeti, or aliens from outer space, or little winged fairies living in gardens, or elves capturing people in dark woodlands and transporting them to Magonia. She didn't believe in ghosts, or astral travel, or near-death experiences, or psychics, or witches, or sorcerers either. Well, maybe she believed in ghosts, and, well, maybe she believed in near-death experiences. Yes, she had known a number of people who had those. But vampires? No, she did not believe in them. Whatever the case, she was intrigued by this series of fictional stories about them, and there was not a single description in any of them of the vampire Lestat, or a single line of dialogue spoken by him that did not check completely with her vision of Uncle Lestan. But that was sheer coincidence, surely. As for Louis, well, the character with a similar name was indeed exactly like him, yes, but that was sheer coincidence too, wasn't it? Well, it had to be. There was no other explanation. Unless they belonged to some organization, her uncle and this man, in which they engaged in role-playing games of some sophisticated sort, modelled after the characters in these novels. But that was ridiculous. Playing roles was one thing. How in the world could anyone make himself look the way Uncle Lestan did? She felt a strange embarrassment at the very thought of asking Uncle Lestan whether or not he'd read these books. It would be insulting and demeaning to do this, she thought, rather like Gardner insulting her when he threw the book at her face and went on with his accusations. But the entire problem began to obsess Rose. Meanwhile she read every last word of every book she could find with these characters. And the stories, in truth, amazed her, not only by their complexity and depth, but by the peculiar dark turns they took, and the chronology they laid out for the main character's moral development. She realized that she was now thinking of Uncle Lestan as that main character. He'd been wounded, shocked, the victim of a series of disasters and adventures. He'd become a wanderer in these books, and his skin was tanned because he kept letting himself suffer the effects of sunlight in a painful attempt to mask his preternatural identity. No, this is impossible. She barely noticed when Marge told her that Gardner had gotten hold of their home number and she had had to change it. Rose keyed the new number into her cell and forgot about it. She didn't use the landline much, but of course it was the principal way to reach Marge, so she had to have that number. "Do you want to tell me what's the matter?" Marge asked. "I know something happened." Rose shook her head. "Just reading, thinking," she said. "I'm better now. I'm going back Monday. I have a lot of catching up to do." In class she could barely keep her mind on the lecture. She kept drifting off, thinking about that long-ago night when Uncle Lestan had caught her in his arms and carried her up and up from that island. She saw him in that dim, shadowy little lawyer's office in Athens, Texas, saying, "Make it happen." Well, there had to be some explanation. And then it struck her. Of course. Her uncle knew the author of these books. Her uncle had, perhaps, inspired them. It was so simple she almost laughed out loud. That had to be it. He and his friend Louis had inspired this fiction, and when she'd tell him she'd found the books, of course he would laugh and explain how they'd come to be written. He'd probably say he'd been honoured to be the inspiration of such bizarre and romantic ramblings. Sitting in the back of a history class, oblivious to the teacher's words, she slipped Interview with a Vampire out of her purse and checked the copyright. 1976. No, that couldn't be right. If her uncle had been a grown man by that time, well, now he'd be nearly 60. No way was Uncle Lestan that old. That was positively ridiculous. But then, how old was he? How old had he been when he'd rescued her from that island earthquake? This wasn't adding up. Maybe he'd been just a boy then when he'd rescued her, and he'd looked like a grown man to her. A boy of, what, 16 or 17, and now he was, what, 40? Well, that was possible, but hardly likely. No, this did not add up, and overshadowing it all was her vivid conviction of his demeanour, his charm. Class was over. Time to shuffle on and go through the motions someplace else, to drift until she saw Murray waiting for her on some curb somewhere. But surely there was a logical explanation. Murray drove her away from the campus to a restaurant she particularly liked, where Marge was to meet her for an early dinner. It was getting dark. They had a regular table, and she was glad that she had a little while to sit there alone, enjoy a badly needed cup of black coffee, and just think to herself. She was looking out the window, paying very little attention to much of anything, when she realized someone had sat down opposite her. It was Gardner. She was badly startled.
"Rose, do you realize what you've done to me?" he asked. His voice was deep and tremulous.
"Look, I want you to leave," she started. He reached across the table and tried to take hold of her hand. Drawing it back, she stood up and stumbled away from the table, running towards the back of the restaurant. She hoped and prayed the one small ladies' room would be empty. Gardner came pounding after her, and when she realized her mistake, it was too late. He'd grabbed hold of her wrist and was dragging her out of the back exit into an alleyway. Murray was all the way around front, parked at the curb.
"Let go of me," she said. "I mean it. I'll scream," she said.
She was as angry as she had been when the book had struck her. Without a word, he dragged her right off her feet and down the alleyway towards his car, and threw her in the passenger side, slamming the door and locking it with his remote. When he went to open the driver's side, he unlocked only that door. She beat on the windows. She screamed,
"Let me go," she said. "How dare you do this to me?"
He started the car, backed out of the alley, and took off down the side street, away from the main boulevard where Murray was no doubt waiting to pay for Marge's taxi. Down a quiet street he drove the car at reckless speed, oblivious to the squeal of the wheels or enjoying it. Rose beat on the windshield, on the side window, and when she could see no one anywhere around, she reached for the key in the ignition. With a resounding blow, he sent her backwards against the passenger door. For a moment she didn't know where she was. Then it came back to her completely and horribly. She struggled to sit up, reaching into her purse and quickly finding the iPhone. She sent the SOS message to Murray. Then Gardner grabbed the purse from her and, buzzing down his window, hurled it out, phone and all. By now the car was speeding through traffic, and she was being thrown from one side to the other as it swerved around one intersection after another. It was making for Old Palo Alto, the neighborhood where Gardner lived, and soon the streets would once again be deserted. Again Rose banged on the windows, gesturing frantically to passing cars, to people on the sidewalk, but no one seemed to notice her. Her screams filled the car. Gardner grabbed her by her hair and pulled her head away from the window. The car slammed to a stop. They were in some side street now, with big trees, those big, beautiful dark green magnolias. He turned her around and held her face in the vise of his thin fingers, his thumb biting painfully into her jaw.
"Who the hell do you think you are?"
he breathed at her, his face dark with rage.
"Who the hell do you think you are to do this to me?"
These were exactly the words she wanted to speak to him, but all she could do was glare at him, her entire body soaked in sweat. She grabbed at his hair with both her hands and yanked it as he'd yanked hers. He hurled her back against the window again and slapped her repeatedly until she was gasping uncontrollably. The car drove on, tires screaming, and as she struggled to sit up again, her face burning, she saw the driveway in front of her, and the old Georgian house looming over her.
"You let me go!"
she screamed. He dragged her from the car, pulling her out the driver's side and dragging her onto her knees on the concrete.
"You don't begin to know what you've done to me!" he roared. "You miserable, stupid girl! You don't begin to grasp what your fun and games have done!"
He dragged her through the door and hurled her across the dining room so that she hit the table hard and sank to the floor. When he lifted her up, she'd lost one of her shoes, and blood was pouring from her face down onto her sweater. He hit her again, and she went out. Out. Next thing Rose knew, she was in the bedroom. She was on the bed, and he was standing over her. He had a glass in his hand. He was talking in a low voice, saying once more how she'd broken his heart, how she'd disappointed him.
"Oh, this has all been the disappointment of my life, Rose," he said. "And I wanted it to be so different, so very different with you, Rose, of all the flowers of the field, you were the fairest, Rose, the fairest of all."
He came towards her as she struggled to get up.
"Now we will drink this together."
She tried to scurry backwards, away from him, off the bed, but his right hand caught her wrist, while with his left hand he held the glass of liquid high out of her reach.
"Now stop it, Rose,"
he growled between his clenched teeth.
"For the love of God, do this with dignity."
Suddenly a pair of headlamps sent their beams over the master bedroom windows. Rose began to scream as loud as she could. It was nothing like those nightmares in which you try to scream and you can't. She was shrieking. The screams just erupted, uncontrollably. He dragged her towards him as he went on and on, shouting over her screams.
"You are the most dreadful disappointment of my life," he cried. "And now, as I seek to make all things new, to make all things whole for you and for me, Rose, you do this to me, to me?"
With the back of his hand he slammed her into the pillow. Out. When she opened her eyes, a foul burning fluid was in her mouth. He had her nose pinched between his fingers. She gagged and bucked and struggled to scream. The taste was ghastly. Her throat was burning. So was her chest. He thrust the half-full glass at her, and the liquid inside it splashed on her face, burning her. The smell was acrid, chemical, caustic. It burned into her cheek and neck. Twisting around as she struggled against his grip, she vomited on the bed. She kicked at him with both feet, but he wouldn't let go. He threw the liquid at her, and she turned with all her strength, feeling it splash against her face. It went into her eyes. It blinded her. Her eyes were on fire. Mari's voice sounded from the hallway door.
"Let her go!"
And then she was free, screaming, crying, grabbing for the covers to wipe the burning liquid off her face and from out of her eyes. The men were scuffling, and the furniture was breaking. There was a loud crash as the mirror on the dresser broke.
"I've got you," said Murray, as he grabbed up Rose and carried her out of the room, running down the steps with her.
She could hear sirens approaching.
"Murray, I'm blind," she sobbed. "Murray, my throat is on fire."
Rose woke up in the ICU. Her eyes were bandaged. Her throat was aching unbelievably, and her hands were strapped so that she couldn't move. Aunt Marge and Murray were with her. Desperately they were trying to reach Uncle Lestan. They would not give up trying. They would find him.
"I'm blind now, aren't I?"
Rose wanted to ask, but she couldn't talk. Her throat wouldn't open. The pain in her chest was grinding. Gardner Pelston was dead, Murray assured her. He'd died from a blow to the head in the fight with Murray. It was an open-and-shut case of attempted murder-suicide. The bastard, as Murray called him, had already posted his suicide note online, fully describing his plan to give Rose the burning hemlock, along with an ode to their mingled, decomposing remains. She heard Aunt Marge begging Murray to stop talking.
"We're going to find Uncle Lestan," Marge said.
Terror engulfed Rose. She couldn't speak. She couldn't see. She couldn't beg for reassurance. She couldn't even tell them about the pain, the unrelenting pain. But Uncle Lestan was coming. He was coming. Oh, what a fool she'd been. Such a fool to have loved Gardner, to have trusted Gardner. She was so ashamed, ashamed as she'd been years ago, lying on the floor of Amazing Grace home. So ashamed. And all the confusion about the books. Those books which had affected her so deeply that for days she'd lived in them, imagining Uncle Lestan to be the hero, rising with him in his arms towards the stars.
"Give me the stars."
She lapsed back into sleep because there was no place else to go. There was no day or night, only an alternating rhythm of activity and noise. More commotion in the room and in the corridor beyond, more voices near at hand, yet muffled, indistinct. Then a doctor was talking to her. He was close by her ear. His voice was soft, deep, resonant, sharpened by an accent she didn't know.
"I am caring for you now," he said. "I will make you well."
They were in an ambulance moving through traffic, and she could feel every bump of the road. The siren was distant but steady, and when she woke next, she knew she was on a plane. She could hear Marge talking softly to someone, but it wasn't Murray. She couldn't hear Murray. Next time she woke, she was in a new bed, a very soft bed, and there was music playing, a lovely song from Romberg's The Student Prince. It was the serenade that long ago Uncle Lestan had sung to her. If her eyes had not been wrapped tight, they would have filled with tears. Maybe they did fill with tears.
"Don't cry, precious dear," said the doctor.
The doctor with the accent. She felt his silken hand on her forehead.
"Our medicines are healing you. By tomorrow this time, your vision will be restored."
Slowly it dawned on her that her chest no longer hurt. There was no pain in her throat. She swallowed freely for the first time in so long. She was dreaming again, and a soft tenor voice, a rather deep voice, was singing Romberg's Serenade. Morning. Rose opened her eyes very slowly, and she saw the light of the sun coming in the windows, and gradually the deep sleep left her, falling away from her as if veils were being drawn back, one after another. It was a beautiful room. A wall of glass looked out on the distant mountains, and between here and there was the desert, golden in the burning sun. There was a man standing with his back to her. At first, the image of him was indistinct against the bright, distant mountains and the deep blue sky. She sighed deeply and turned her head easily back and forth on the pillow. Her hands were free, and she brought them up to touch her face. She touched her lips, her moist lips. The young man came into focus. Broad shoulders, tall, maybe 6 feet tall, with luxuriant blonde hair. Could it be Uncle Lestan? Just as his name rose to her lips, the figure turned to face her and came towards the bed. Oh, how completely he resembled Uncle Lestan! But he was younger, definitely younger. He was the image of Uncle Lestan in a young boy. "Hello, Rose," he said, smiling down at her. "I'm so glad you're awake." Suddenly her vision dimmed, blurred, and a pain shot through her temples and her eyes. But it was gone, this pain, as quickly as it had come, and she could see again. Her eyes were only dry and itching. She could see perfectly.
"Who are you?" she asked.
"I'm Victor," said the boy. "I'm here to be with you now."
"But Uncle Lestan? Is he coming?"
"They're trying to find him. It's not always easy to find him. But when he finds out what happened to you, I promise you he will come." The young boy's face was cheerful, fresh, his smile generous and almost sweet. He had large blue eyes, so like Uncle Lestan's, but it was the hair and the shape of his face more than anything that locked in the resemblance.
"Precious Rose," he said, in a soft, even voice,
an American voice that had nevertheless a kind of crisp enunciation to it. He explained that Aunt Marge could not be here now in this place, but Rose was safe, completely safe from all harm, and he, Victor, would see to that, and so would the nurses. The nurses would take care of her every need. "You've had surgery after surgery," Victor said, "but you're improving wonderfully, and soon you'll be fully yourself again."
"Where is the doctor?"
Rose asked. When he reached for her hand, she clasped his.
"He'll come tonight, after sunset," said Victor. "He can't be here now." "Like a vampire," she said, musing, laughing softly under her breath.
He laughed with her, gently, softly.
"Yes, very like that, Rose," he said. "But where is the prince of the vampires? My Uncle Lestan?"
Never mind that Victor would never in a thousand years understand her mad humour. He would ascribe it to the sedatives that were making her loopy and almost content.
"The prince of the vampires will come, I assure you," Victor answered. "As I said, they are searching for him now."
"You're so like him," she said dreamily. There came that pain again to her eyes and that blurring vision, and it seemed for one instant that the window was on fire. She turned her head away in a panic. But the pain stopped, and she could see clearly all the objects of this room. What a pretty room! Painted a cobalt blue and with bright white enameled mouldings. And on the wall a brilliant painting of roses, wild, exploding roses against a backdrop of a darker blue.
"But I know that painting. That's my painting," she said. "That's from my bedroom at home."
"All your things are here now, Rose," said Victor. "Just tell me whatever you want. We have your books, your clothes, everything. You'll be able to get up in a few days." A nurse came into the room, soundlessly, and appeared to be checking the equipment that surrounded the bed. For the first time, Rose saw the glistening plastic sacks of IV fluid, the slender, gleaming silver cords that ran to the needles taped to her arms. She really was drugged. One moment she thought her mind was clear, and the next she was astonished or confused. Clothes. Get up. Books.
"Any pain, darling?"
asked the nurse. She had soft brown skin and large, sympathetic brown eyes.
"No. But whatever it is, give me more of it," she laughed. "I'm floating. I believe in vampires."
"Don't we all?" asked the nurse. She made some adjustment in the IV feed.
"There now," she said, "you'll be sleeping again soon enough. When you sleep, you heal, and that's what you must do now. Heal."
Her shoes made a soft squeaking noise as she left the room. Rose drifted, and then she saw Victor again smiling down at her. Well, Uncle Lestan never wore his hair that short, did he? And never did he wear that kind of sweater vest, even if it was cashmere, or a pink shirt like that, open at the neck.
"You look so like him," she said.
In the distance, she heard the serenade again, that plaintive, painful music trying to describe beauty, pure beauty, and so heartbreakingly sad.
"But he sang that to me when I was little."
"You told us this," said Victor, "and that's why we're playing it for you now." I could swear you look more like him than any human being I've ever seen in my life.
Victor smiled.
Why, it was that same smile, that same infectious and loving smile.
That's because I'm his son, said Victor.
Uncle Lestan's son? She said.
She was so drowsy.
Did you say you were his son?
She sat up, staring at him.
My God in heaven! You are his son. I had no idea that he had a son.
He doesn't have any idea either, Rose, said Victor. He bent over her and kissed her forehead. She put her arms around him, the wires streaming from their needles. I've been waiting such a long time, he said, to tell him myself.
6. Cyril. He slept for months at a time, sometimes years. Why not? In a cave on Mount Fuji, he had slept for centuries. There were years when he slept in Kyoto. Now he was in Tokyo. He didn't care. He was thirsty and crazed. He'd been having bad dreams, dreams of fire. He crawled from his hiding place and went out into the teeming nighttime streets. Rain. Yes, cooling rain. Didn't matter to him much who the victim was, as long as it was young and strong enough to survive that first bite. He wanted hearts that would pump the blood into him. He wanted that blood being pumped by another heart through his heart. As he walked deeper and deeper into the Ginza district of the city, the neon lights delighted him and made him happy. Lights flickering, dancing, racing up and down and across on the borders of great moving pictures. Lights! He decided to take his time. Strange it was that, when he emerged from his hiding places, he always knew the languages and the ways of the people who were nearest to them. He was never surprised so much as delighted by their goings-on. Rain couldn't stop the crush of people here, the beautiful, fresh-faced, scrubbed and scented children of this century, so rich, so innocent, so willing to provide him with draught after draught of their blood.
Drink because I want you. I have much for you to do.
Ah, there was that nagging voice, that being talking inside his head. Who was this arrogant blood-drinker Shogun who thought he could tell Cyril what to do? He wiped his lips with the back of his hand. Human beings were staring at him. Well, let them stare. His brown hair was filthy, of course, and so were the rags he wore, but he accelerated his pace, skillfully, moving fast away from prying eyes. Then he looked down. He was barefoot. And who's to say that I can't be barefoot? He laughed under his breath. After he'd fed, he would bathe, wash himself properly, and make himself blend in. However did he get here, to this country? He wondered. Sometimes he could remember, and sometimes he could not. And why was he seeking out this particular place, a narrow building that he kept seeing in his mind?
You know what I want of you.
No, I don't, he said aloud. And there's no telling I'll do it.
Oh, yes, you will,
came the answer very distinctly, right inside his brain.
If you do not do what I wish, I will punish you.
He laughed. You think you can? Other blood drinkers had been threatening to punish him ever since he could remember. Long ago, on the flank of Mount Fuji, an ancient blood drinker had said to him, "This is my land." Well, guess what happened to him? He laughed when he thought of it. But long before that, he'd been laughing at threats from those around him, those blood drinker priests of her temple, always threatening to punish him if he didn't do her will. He had marvelled at the timidity of the blood gods who submitted to her inane rules. And when he'd brought his fledglings right into the temple to drink her blood, those cowardly priests had backed off, not daring to challenge him.
The last time he'd brought that pretty girl, that Greek girl Eudoxia, and told her to drink from the mother. Those priests had been in a rage. And what about the mother? She'd been nothing more than a statue full of the blood by that time. So much for stories of divinity and high calling, and reasons to suffer and sacrifice and obey. Even if he went way back, as far as he could recall, to the very first time he'd been in her presence, brought there by the elder to drink from her and become a blood god, he thought it was foolishness, lies. He'd been sly enough to do what they told him. Ah, that blood had felt so good. And what had life been for him before that? Back-breaking labour, hunger, his father's constant bullying. All right, I'll die and be reborn, and then I'll smash in your faces with my new godly fists. He knew a blood god was infinitely stronger than a human being. You want to give me that power? I'll bend the knee. But you'll regret it, my sanctimonious friends.
Drink,
said the being talking in his head. Now, choose one of the victims the world offers you. You don't have to tell me how to do it, you fool, he said, spitting the words into the rain. He'd stopped, and they were staring at him, and then he did this feint he had perfected, falling down on his knees, then rising, head bowed, as he staggered into a deep but small shop in a narrow building, where only one serving girl waited for a customer, and came towards him with arms out, asking if he were ill. It was so simple to force her into the storage room behind the little emporium and hold her tight in one arm as he sank his fangs into her neck. She shuddered and shivered like a bird in his grasp, words strangled in her throat. The blood was sweet with innocence, with deep convictions of harmony amongst all the creatures of the planet, with some exalted sense that this encounter now, which clouded her mind and ultimately paralyzed her, must have meaning. Else how could such a thing happen to her? She lay on the floor at his feet. He was reflecting on the quality of the blood, so rich, so healthy, so filled with exotic flavors, so different from blood in the time he'd been made. Ah, these robust and powerful modern humans, what a world of food and drink they enjoyed. The blood was sharpening his vision, as it always did, and calming something in him for which he had no name. He snapped off the electric lights in the storage room and waited. Within seconds a pair of customers had come into the shop, a big, gawky boy and a pale, emaciated European girl. "Back here," he said, beckoning to them, smiling at them, focusing his precious power right on their eyes, glancing from one to the other. "Come." This was his favourite way to do it, with a tender throat in each hand, taking one and then the other, suckling, lapping, sloshing the hot, salty blood around in his mouth, then going at it again, and then the first victim again, letting both weaken at the same gentle speed, until he was satisfied. He could drink no more. 3 deaths now had passed through him in wrenching spasms. He was hot and tired, and he felt like he could see through walls as well as walk through them. He was full. He took the boy's shirt, white and fresh and clean, and he put that on. The dungarees were all right, too, and the leather belt fit. The shoes were big and soft and laced up, and they felt loose to him, but it was better than being stared at, better than having to fight with some little gang of mortals and then flee them, though it was easy enough to do. Now, with a young European woman's hairbrush, he cleaned all the dust and soil from his brown hair, and with her dress he wiped off his face and hands. It made him sad to look at them dead, the 3 of them, his victims, and he had to admit it always did.
"What sentimental nonsense," said the being talking inside him. "You shut up. What do you know?" he said aloud.
He walked through the brightly lighted store and back out into the throng in the streets. The lighted towers rose on either side of him. The lights were so beautiful to him, so magical, climbing higher and higher into the sky, strips of blue and red and yellow and orange, and all that artful lettering. He liked their lettering, the Japanese. It made him think of the writing of the old times, when people had carefully painted their words on papyrus and on walls. Why did he turn off the beautiful thoroughfare? Why did he leave behind the crowds? There it was, the little hotel he'd been seeking. That's where they hid from the world, the pesky young ones, the foolish and blundering blood-drinker riff-raff.
Ah, yes, and you will burn them now. Burn them all. Burn the building. You have the power to do it. The power is inside you, here with me.
Was that really what he wanted to do?
Do as I have told you to do,
said the angry voice now in words. What do I care about all those blood-drinkers hiding in there? He said aloud. Weren't they simply lost and lonely and dragging themselves through eternity just as he was? Burn them? Why?
The power, said the being. You have the power. Look at the building. Let the heat collect in your mind. Focus it, then send it forth.
It had been so long since he'd attempted something like that. It was tempting to see if he could do it. And suddenly he was doing it. Yes, he felt the heat, felt it as if his own head would explode. He saw the facade of the little hotel waver, heard it crackle, and saw the flames erupting everywhere.
Kill them as they come out!
Within seconds, the hotel was a tower of flame, and they were rushing right towards him, right into the path of the one who was burning them. It was like a game, throwing the beam at one, and then another, and another. They were each individual torches for an instant, dying quickly to the rainy pavement. His head ached. He staggered backwards. A woman stood by the entrance, sobbing, reaching out to one of the young ones who'd been burnt to the ground. She was old. It would take such heat to burn her. I don't want to. I don't want to do any of this.
Ah, but you do. Now, lift her out of her pain and her suffering.
Yes, such pain and such suffering. He sent the blast at her with all his strength. Throwing up her arms, she threw a blast of her own towards him, but her face and arms were already turning black. Her clothes were on fire. Her legs gave out. Another blast and she was finished, and then another and another, and only her bones gave off smoke as they melted. He had to be quick. He had to get those who had escaped from the back. Through the burning building he ran, easily picking them out when he re-emerged into the rain. Two, three, then a fourth. And there were no more. He sat slumped against a wall, and the rain soaked through his white shirt.
Come, said the dictatorial voice. You are dear to me now. I love you. You have done my will, and I will reward you. Now, get away from me, he said disgustedly. I don't do anyone's will.
Oh, but you have?
No,
he said. He got to his feet, the cloth shoes wet and heavy. Disgustedly, he tore them off his feet and threw them away. He walked on and on. He was walking out of this immense city. He was walking away from all this.
I have work for you in other places, said the being.
Not for me, he said.
You betray me.
Weep by yourself over that. It's nothing to me. He stopped. He could hear other blood-drinkers in the night in far distant places. He could hear voices screaming. Where were these dreadful cries coming from? He told himself he didn't care.
I will punish you, said the being, if you defy me.
His voice was angry again. But very soon, as Cyril walked on and on, the creature fell silent. The creature was gone. Well before morning he'd reached the open countryside, and he dug deep into the earth to sleep for as long as he could. But the nagging voice had come back to him at sunset.
There isn't much time. You must go to Kyoto. You must destroy them.
He ignored the orders. The voice grew angrier and angrier, as it had last night.
I will send another,
the voice threatened,
and some night soon I will banish you.
On he slept. He dreamed of flames, but he didn't care. He wasn't doing that any more, no matter what happened. But sometime during the night he saw the old vampire refuge in Kyoto burning, and he heard those awful screams again.
"I will punish you,"
in a perfect imitation of American slang, which he'd come to love, he answered, "Good luck with that."
7. The Story of Antoine. He had died at the age of 18, born to darkness, in weakness and confusion, beaten, burned, and left for dead along with his maker. In his fragile, short human life, he'd played the piano only, studying at the Conservatoire de Paris when he was but 10 years old. A genius he'd been called, and, oh, the Paris of those times, Bizet, Saint-Saëns, Berlioz, even Franz Liszt, he'd seen them, heard their music, known them all. He might have become one of them. But his brother had betrayed him, fathering a child out of wedlock and selecting him, a third son, aged 17, to take the blame for the scandal. Off to Louisiana he'd been shipped, with a fortune that funded his ruin through drink and his nightly attendance at the gambling tables. Only now and then did he vengefully attack the piano in some fashionable parlour or hotel lobby, delighting and confusing happenstance audiences with a riot of broken and violent riffs and incoherent melodies. Taken up by whores and patronesses of the arts alike, he traded upon his looks, jet-black wavy hair, very white skin, and famously deep blue eyes, and a baby Cupid's bow mouth that others liked to kiss and touch with their fingertips. He was tall but gangly, fragile-looking, but notoriously strong, able to land a punch with ease to break the jaw of anyone who might try to harm him. Fortunately, he had never broken his precious piano fingers doing such things, but knowing it well might happen, he'd taken to carrying a knife and a pistol, and he was no stranger either to the rapier, and attended a few times at least a fashionable New Orleans fencing establishment. Mostly he fell apart, disintegrated, lost things, woke up in strange bedrooms, got sick with tropical fever, or from bad food, or from drinking himself into a stupor. He had no respect for this raw, mad, essentially colonial town. It wasn't Paris, this disgusting American place. It might as well have been hell for all he cared. If the devil kept pianos in hell, what did it matter? Then Lestat de Liancourt, that paragon of fashion who lived in the Rue Royale with his trusted friend Louis de Pointe-Gulac and their little ward Claudia, had come into his life with his fabled generosity and swaggering abandon. Those days! Ah, those days! How beautiful they seemed in retrospect, and how raw and ugly they had been in fact. That crumbling city of New Orleans, the filth of it, the relentless rains, the mosquitoes, and the stench of death from the soggy graveyards, the lawless riverfront streets, and that enigmatic gentleman in exile, Lestat, sustaining him, putting gold in his hands, luring him away from the bars and the roulette wheels, and urging him to pound the nearest keyboard. Lestat had purchased for him the finest pianoforte that he could find, a magnificent Broadwood Grand, shipped from England, and played at one time by the great Frédéric Chopin. Lestat had brought servants to clean up his flat. Lestat had hired a cook to see that he ate before he drank, and Lestat had told him that he had a gift, and that he must believe in it. Such a charmer! Lestat, in his elegant black frock coats and glossy four-in-hands, marching up and down on the antique Savonnerie carpet, urging him on with a wink and a flashing smile, his blonde hair bushy and rebellious down to his crisp white collar. He smelled of clean linen, fresh flowers, the spring rain. "Antoine, you must compose," Lestat had told him. Paper, ink, everything he needed for his writing. And then those ardent embraces, shrill and chilling kisses, when oblivious to the silent and devoted servants they lay in the big cypress four-poster bed together beneath the flaming red silk tester.
so cold, Lestat had seemed, yet so rampantly affectionate. Hadn't those kisses now and then hurt with a tiny sting, like an insect, biting into his throat? What did he care? The man intoxicated him.
"Compose for me,"
he'd whispered in Antoine's ear, and the command imprinted itself on Antoine's heart. Sometimes he composed for 24 hours without stopping, never mind the endless noise from the crowded muddy street outside his windows, then fell down from exhaustion to sleep over the piano itself in a stupor. Then Lestat, in those shining white gloves and with that glistening silver walking stick, was there, blazing before him, face moist and cheeks ruddy.
"Here, get up now, Antoine. You've slept enough. Play for me."
"Why do you believe in me?" he'd asked.
"Play!"
Lestat pointed to the piano keys. Lestat danced in circles as Antoine played, looking up into the smoky light of the crystal chandelier.
"That's it! More! That's it!"
And then Lestat himself would flop down into the gold fauteuil behind the desk and begin writing with superb speed and accuracy the notes that Antoine was playing. What had happened to all those songs, all those sheets of parchment, all those leather folders of music? How lovely it had been, those candlelight hours, curtains blowing in the wind, and sometimes people gathered on the banquette below to listen to his playing. Until that awful night when Lestat had come to demand his allegiance. Scarred, filthy, dressed in rags that reeked of the swamp, Lestat had become a monster.
"They tried to kill me," he said in a harsh whisper. "Antoine, you must help me."
Not the precious child, Claudia. Not the precious friend, Louis de Pointe-du-Lac. You cannot mean this. Murderers? Those two? The picture-perfect pair who glided through the early evenings as if in some shared dream as they walked the new flagstone pavements? Then, as this ragged and crippled creature had fastened itself to Antoine's throat, Antoine had seen it all in visions, seen the crime itself, seen his lover savaged again and again by the monster child's knife, seen Lestat's body dumped into the swamp, seen him rise. Antoine now knew everything. The dark blood had rushed into his body like a burning fluid, exterminating every human particle in its path. The music, his own music, rose in his ears in dizzying volume. Only music could describe this ineffable power, this raging euphoria. They had been defeated, both of them, when they went against Claudia and Louis, and Antoine had been hideously burned. That is how Antoine learned what it meant to be born to darkness. You could suffer burns like that and endure. You could suffer what should have meant death for a human being, and you could go on. Music and pain, they were the twin mysteries of his existence. Even the dark blood itself did not obsess him, as did music and pain. As he lay on the four-poster beside Lestat, Antoine saw his pain in bright, flashing colours, his mouth open in a perpetual moan. "I cannot live like this." And yet he didn't want to die. No, never to die, not even now, not even with the craving for human blood, driving him out into the night, though his body was nothing but pain. Pain scraped by the fabric of his shirt, his trousers, even his boots. Pain and blood and music. For 30 mortal years he'd lived like a monster, hideous, scarred, preying on the weakest of mortals, hunting in the crowded Irish immigrant slums for his meals. He could make his music without ever touching the keys of a piano. He heard the music in his head, heard it surge and climb as he moved his fingers in the air, the mingled noises of the rat-infested slums, the roaring laughter from a stevedore's tavern became a new music to him, caught in the low rumble of voices to the right and to the left, or the cries of his victims. Blood! Give me blood! Music I will possess forever. Lestat had gone to Europe, chasing after them those two, Claudia and Louis, who had been his family, his friends, his lovers. But he had been terrified to attempt such a journey, and he had left Lestat at the docks.
"Goodbye to you, Antoine," Lestat had kissed him. "Maybe you will have a life here in the new world, the life I wanted."
Gold and gold and gold.
keep the rooms, keep the things I've given you.
But he hadn't been clever like Lestat. He had no skill for living like a mortal among mortals, not with these songs in his head, these symphonies, and the blood ever beckoning. His own legacy he'd squandered, and Lestat's gold was gone too at last, though where or how he could never remember. He had left New Orleans, journeying north, sleeping in the cemetery.